on the channel. Many people look at, call it Bart Simpson's haircut. In other words, it looks like a rectangle of noise, a flat top of noise across the whole darn channel. 6 megs of bandwidth, almost, with very steep skirts on the sides. It's got a very characteristic, different-looking appearance. And the way they bury all of that information in there is a little bit equivalent to 64 QAM or 16 QAM, quad amplitude modulation. In other words, there's a kind of amplitude and phase modulation simultaneously, such that there is a number of bits per symbol. In other words, even though the channel is 6 megs wide, they're transmitting a lot more than 6 megahertz of information. And at first it sounds like it's violation of Shannon's law. It's not. I mean, your television, your plain old telephone system, your PoT system, has got around 3.5 kilohertz of bandwidth. But by using fancy modulation techniques, you can put 56 kilobits of information through that 3.5 kilohertz of bandwidth. And so digital television is doing something similar, burying multiple channels within one with one bandwidth and a lot more information. So when it comes to this heating tape, which is the other subject on the table here, go right ahead, Bob, and what's the brand name on all that? W2PNJ, HYW the Technic.
Okay, the company name is Raychem, R-A-Y-C-H-E-M, and it's called WinterGuard, W-I-N-T-E-R-G-A-R-D, West, WinterGuard West. And the part number is H's and Harry, 612-100, and 6 watts per foot, 120 volts. It comes with a 100-foot reel of heating cable, 2 power connecting kits, 1 splice, and a T-kit if you're going to make a T, and a 66-foot roll of application tape. This is the only item that's listed by Canadian Standards Association and the Underwriters Laboratory. It's the only one that I would recommend to put in your house because you don't want to burn the house down. And it's called Raychem Pipe Freeze Protection Roof and Gutter De-icing Heating Cables. It's made to go on the roof. It's made to go in the gutter.
Fantastic. I think you said it comes down 100 foot per reel. Roughly, what's a rough guess as to the price of 100 foot reel of that at Granger?
I think this is a couple $100, this kit. But remember, I've had it for 2 years. I didn't put it in yet. Talk about procrastination.
Okay, a little bit on the pricey side, but all the grief and avoid, it's probably a good investment. And so, situations where it must, by law, be installed by a licensed contractor, and then we can receive a UL or whatever inspection after that. Thank you, Bob.
If you follow the directions carefully, do not nick it, of course. You know, when you're running it through the gutter, not catching it on the edge of aluminum and ripping it open, it doesn't come down, you know what I mean? It's got a as the temperature goes down, it starts to conduct. It's very safe. It's the only product that I would recommend because it's the only one that's listed by the Canadian Standards Association and the United States Underwriters Lab. It's the only way to go because there's stuff that Home Depot sells. I wouldn't go to bed at night and under the same roof with that stuff on the outside.
I hear you. And this stuff not only can be laid in the gutter to get rid of the ice, I have the impression you could also wrap it around a copper pipe that happens to be exposed to the weather. Is that true? To keep it from freezing?
Yeah, absolutely. It can be used indoors because they make one that's called WinterGuard Plus. Heating cables for pipe freeze protection of large diameter pipes. They sell the material for indoors, but this is WinterGuard West. More expensive, made for outside. This is made for outside. They show you a picture of it running on a roof. It looks like a sine wave, you know, 2 or 3 feet above the edge of the gutter. Running, you know, they show you it's attached to the roof shingles, and then they're going into the gutter, running in the gutter.
Okay. That sounds like the right material to get rid of what's called ice dams. We don't get it as much here on Long Island, but New England people get a wicked problem. I, living at a place 300 feet above sea level in Huntington, I get ice dams periodically. And what ice dam means is that the whole roof fills up with snow. A slightly warm day comes along, the flow starts melting, but it melts a little bit and eventually refreezes right in front of a gutter on the roof. So it creates a dam of ice. And then the remaining water that tries to melt in the middle of the roof comes down to that dam, doesn't get a chance, it runs into that barrier, doesn't get any place to go, it crawls under your tar paper and starts dripping inside the house. So if you don't do something to melt the ice that forms near the soffit to the Raycat Winter Guard wet material, wouldn't be quite appropriate to be placed there. I presume it's held down, in that case, with some kind of fence to make sure you don't cut into it. And also, I imagine there's some kind of a fancy holder that should be used inside of the gutter to make sure it doesn't shift around. Back to you, Bob.
That's correct. It comes with a... It's a large box. The box is 12 inches square by 6 inches high, fairly heavy, and it's got all the material you'll need to do a proper installation. They sell it long if you need a longer length, which is, you know, a lot more money. But this is a 100-foot kit. This is the smallest it comes. And I priced it at Granger, and I priced it at W.W. Granger, and I priced it at Graybar, and I was able to get it for a cheaper price at Graybar.
Okay, good information. So Graybar also sells it. Graybar also sells these beautiful earth screw anchors. They make these 8-inch diameter Archimedes screw things, which has got a 1-inch diameter piece of galvanized steel rod going down the center. It's 4.5 or 5 feet long. When you sink that into normal soil, it's got an eye on the top, and you sink it into the soil by turning it, and that's ground with proper installation. It has 12,000 pounds of holding force, an earth screw anchor made by A.D. Chant. The 8-inch diameter ones. And they make much bigger ones. But the 12,000 pounds holding each one of your guy wires for your tower is more than enough. In my case, I've got rocks and roots and all kinds of things down there. I've got to sink them a couple of times before I finally get them to go all the way. And when you use a thing like that, make sure you sink it to full depth. If you only sink it to 1/2 the depth, you get 1/8 the holding force. And I can explain that mathematically if need be. You'd be amazed how many people think that the holding force is only a function of the diameter of the plate. It's a function of the diameter of the plate and the depth of that plate, because it's trying to pull up a cone of dirt at a 60-degree angle is the apex of the cone. That's the way Mother Nature behaves. When you pull a flat object out of the ground, when the ground is properly settled after it's been rained on a few times, that's another whole area. Okay. It's very interesting, Bob. You've given us a lot of information tonight. I thought we were going to discuss high-gain antennas tonight. We got into... Well, that's right, Bob. You had questions, and we're going to hang in here and make sure all your questions are answered. Go right ahead, Bob.
Mine are a lot simpler. I have my Mosley Mini 33 walk beam for 10 to 20 meters, plus the WARC bands on it. I want to work 40. I want to work 80. I have a property that's 75 feet wide, 200 some odd feet deep. What kind of an antenna, wire antenna I could put up? Because I have trees in the back. One end could be tied to the mast. I need an antenna that's fed on the end where I could bring the coax right into the house instead of having to schlep it in the middle, you know, and bring it into the house that way. Any suggestions?
Yep, Rich, you're a little bit noisy, Rich. Rich is going to have some suggestions. I have some suggestions. N-fed sub is one kind of an antenna. That would definitely work. Dipole-like antenna where you run the coax for a while over to the center of the antenna. Modern-day coax cables at 80 and 40 meters have got so little loss. The fact you've got to run it halfway across the yard to meet the middle of the dipole if you try to put up a dipole. The highest performance antenna out of simple wire is a balanced dipole with a proper balancing device, in my opinion. N-fed depth, unless you're real careful, you tend to end up with a little bit of RF energy flowing on the outside of the cable. And if you're not careful, you can end up with a fair amount of RF crawling back into the shack. And if you were using a D104 mic, you'd sometimes get a spark between the mic and your lip, so to speak. You'd have a hot system. N-fed depth tend to do that. Now, when it comes to the dipole itself, the good news is that it does not have to be out flat, parallel to the ground. You can take that dipole, you can tilt the ends up, down, left, right. The dipole can zigzag, put loading coils. You can do a zillion things to the dipole. Common sense would lead you to believe that when the dipole is made physically smaller, because you're trying to squeeze it on the narrow dimension of your property or whatever, common sense would lead you to believe that the dipole goes down in gain as a function of physical length. Absolutely, positively not. I have earned a small fortune, but with the right kind of a matching network, you come right back to full performance. For every watt you put in, it gets radiated in the space. And the difference in the pattern between a physically small and zigzagged dipole and a full-out flat dipole, the difference in gain is always well under a dB. And on an S-meter, you'll never see the difference. So, once you realize that the nicest antenna to feed, in my opinion, is a fully symmetric antenna with a balancing device at the end of the cable that feeds the dipole, and the dipole itself can zigzag up, down, left, right, make it into coils, wrap it around trees, do all kinds of things with the dipole. It's not going to radiate like a dipole. It does that. The RF energy, you're pouring RF energy into that piece of wire, and as long as that wire, with its matching box and feed line, as long as you resonate it at 40 meters and resonate it at 80 meters, and it's a radiating system you're resonating. Antenna plus feed line plus antenna tuner. As long as that system resonates, every watt you put into it, 0.99 of that watt is going to be radiated into space in a dipole-like pattern. Now, you may end up with a null antenna book by Krauss, a Bible on the subject of antennas. His original McGraw-Hill book was published in 1950. The latest third edition was published in 1992. Take any one of those three books and you look at the section labeled the infinitesimal dipole. As you make the dipole shorter and shorter in length of wire, even though you're stretching it out straight, it becomes a little bit hard to impedance match. But once you impedance match it, it's still 100% efficient. It becomes narrowband, the Q goes up, and you have to readjust your matchbox a little bit more frequently as your QSY, but it will still radiate with 100% efficiency. Let's see what Rich has to add to all this. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, TechNet2EO. Well, I was going to suggest the same thing you did, except I'm a big proponent of when using that type of antenna, using open wire line. A lot of people think open wire line radiates because there's no shield. Not true, because when the tuner is matched, you go through a tuner with a balancing device and all the coax short jump into the radio and you bring the SW1 down to 1-to-1 with a tuner. The line is said to be tuned, so each side is 180 degrees out of phase on the other side, and it cancels. And there's literally no RF radiation off of open wire line when the line is tuned. And I have an 80-meter dipole. It's actually an inverted zinc fed in standard with open wire line. I run 1500 watts into it with a Metatron AL1500. This is an 8877. I have no problem. Thank you, K2RIW, tested by Mark and Julio.
Great, Brian Rich. Yeah. It's interesting to note that McKay Radio and Humpog, RCA in Rocky Point, and the installation out in Riverhead, they were running for Crest Wireless 10 kilowatt transmitters on HF frequency, all fed with open wire line very efficiently. So if you've got a fairly long run, open wire line is the way to go. You don't have to use open wire line. There are people who misuse coax, develop some bad attitude about coax, stop using it, and went over open line. Properly used at 80 and 40 meters, a good piece of coax and reasonable length of it is going to have a very low loss. So when it comes to the transmission line you use, you've got a lot of choices. When it comes to the antenna itself, you've got a lot of choices. That's for just dipole-like antennas. And if you want to make a beam on 80 meters or 40 meters, because you really want to light up Europe or South America or whatever, there are ways with setting up ropes as a catenary between the trees, strung with wires in between them, actors operate as a reflector-driven element and director, or maybe even two directors. You won't be able to aim it very easily. You won't be able to rotate it. But if you've got a whole lot of gain, you'd be amazed how much gain with wire and rope you can squeeze into your backyard there, LeBron. W2PNJ, KQRIW, the TechNet.
Okay, KQRIW, W2PNJ. I have Krause's book, Son of a Gun. You know, you said antennas, the McGraw-Hill book, the black book with the red bands, the red stripe down the middle. Mine is a 1950 edition. And I'm looking at chapter 5, and it says the electric dipole and thin linear antennas, and section of chapter 5.1, the short electric dipole. This is the one?
That's the one. And there's a section there that he either calls it electrically short, or he might even in one spot call it the infinitesimal dipole. That book is the Bible of antenna testing. 1950 McGraw-Hill, John D. Krause, I think his name is. I've talked to him a few times. No longer alive. W-A-J-K. Brilliant guy. Anyhow, he wrote the book, and when it comes to shrinking dipoles infinitesimally small, they become very narrowband, and they require a more and more sturdy antenna tuner to bring them back into resonance. And therefore, the amount of loss of the line, which is going to run a higher and higher standing wave ratio on the edges of the band, when you tune into the center of the band, the matchbox has got to do more, and therefore the feed line is going to work a little harder, and maybe it's appropriate to go over to open wire line as Rich is recommending. But you've got the book, and so ain't it crazy? When you study that book enough, you come to a couple of conclusions that are very different than common sense. One, you can make an 80 meter dipole in theory a couple of feet long. And although the voltage on it will go sky high, and you may arc it over in the air when you resonate it, still, as long as you don't arc it over, and as long as it does resonate, it will radiate every watt you put into it. And if you compare the gain of a dipole that is a couple of feet long compared to a full 80-meter dipole at 130 feet, any normal human being will say, hey, fella, by common sense, you're telling me that 130 feet of wire has got the exact same gain as that thing with the matchbox that's only a couple of feet long and the dipole radiating at 80 meters, and the answer within a fraction of a dB is yes. And you study that section of Krause, and you'll come to that conclusion. And another good thing that Krause has got in there, I try to remember now. Effective area of antennas. I'll admit he's got too much mathematics and too few diagrams in the first edition, the 1950 edition. If you do manage to go to your library, because you probably don't want to buy it, it's a $130 book. I own the third edition, beautiful colored hardcover on the outside, again, McGraw-Hill. And the third edition has got a lot of computer-generated graphics, but all of them still tell you the same thing on the section I'm trying to talk about now. What is it? Just went out of my head. Insertion loss, gain, capture area. An 80-meter dipole made out of full wire, 130 feet long, casts a shadow on the ground of probably 1 square foot if you made it out of 14-gauge wire. So the wire itself has a shadow area at high noon of 1 square foot. Electronically speaking, when that antenna is transmitting or receiving, let's just talk about receiving because it's easier to see what's going on. In the receiving mode, to a signal that is horizontally polarized, coming at that wire dipole at a broadside angle, the dipole is gathering RF energy out of a chunk of space that is an ellipse. The ellipse is a little bit wider in the long dimension than the wire is long, and it's only half as wide in the opposite direction. 8,500 square feet of effective capture area is that resonated 80-meter half-wave dipole. 8,500 square feet because it resonates. Your 80-meter dipole may be 60 feet above the ground. It may be directly behind the light on power lines that are 30 feet in front of you, in front of your house, and the power lines of your altitude parallel with you in the domains of fatter, and there's more of them. I ain't going to get any signal in that direction. Good common sense. Dead wrong. The wire of the LICO wiring, or LIPO wiring, is non-resonant. It has a couple of square feet of shadow area. Your 80-meter dipole with the exact same shadow area, because it is resonating at 8,500 square feet. Therefore, that signal coming in from Europe that has to first sift through those LICO wires before it gets to your dipole is going to experience 0.01 dB of loss. Common sense would lead you to believe you ain't going to get no signal in that direction, except from arcing and stalking you might get because of a plug-pick transformer or insulator problem. Those wires are not there. Ain't that interesting? You study, as I said, that information is in that book. I'll admit that section I just told you about is more mathematical, not as easy to understand at first. But believe me, it's there, and once you study it, and you convince yourself it really is there, and it's traceable to the Bureau, and everyone accepts it, and it's the bedrock of the antenna measuring science, that book, and the JASTIC Antenna Engineering Handbook, modern version is called Johnson. These two books really tell you everything you want to know about antennas. When you take the time to study them. You got a damn good book there, 72PNJ, KQI, W, the Tech Man.
Okay. Thank you for a wealth of information. I got this book when I worked for RAMCOR. It used to be called Radar Measurement Corporation. That was before I became an electrician, probably in 1970. Okay, great. Thanks for the info. I'll be on the side listening. Thanks again, guys. We had a handshake at the handprint. I was sitting to the right of Baloo, W2BIE, under the tent. Take care, buddy.
Yeah, that was at the Limark table, as I remember. Well done. Okay. And let us, come on back and let us know how you filled up that backyard of yours with wire, and how you're going to make a catenary rope-type dipole, or yahi. By the way, there are guys that go to South Sea Island, the Rowan, and they aim it at a particular point in the sky that they calculate, and a day later the moon fills up that point in the sky. They transmit a 2-meter signal with these modern digital encoding techniques through that wire yagi antenna, and they do moon bounce on 2 meters with an antenna that weighs about 100 pounds, and it can easily be packed into a shipping trunk contact. So you have more real estate than you know about that can make a lot of gain with some of the technology you have access to, Bob. Good luck with that project, and let us know how you're going to be lighted in tonight. Paul, you know who you are. Go right ahead. Tell us what's going on in space. Can't you lie, W, the tech man?
Control, and operator, change.
And tell us.
Looks down toward the Earth. So, this thing would be a gigantic viewing area, probably about 10 feet in diameter. And 6 different windows with shutters on the outside that they'll be able to close them if need be, especially if they ever want to change out the windows on the inside. So they've got a long way to go with the International Space Station. 15 flights, a lot of work. Busy Clooney and Spirit riding around on Mars, one on one side of the planet, one on the other. And we're coming up to 3 years, January. These things will be cutting along on their electric power supplied by the sun. And right now, Spirit is looking like that is having a lot of problems. That one wheel just does not work at all. They drag it around all over the right front wheel. One out of six, still not bad. But that thing's shot. That doesn't turn it at all anymore. And now with the winter time on Mars, even though these things are located pretty near the Martian equator, I think they're around 15 degrees off the equator, it still gets a little on the dark side. Not enough daylight during the day. Spirit is now getting only about a half hour drive time per day. So that's not too good. So they're going to keep at it. Hope they keep ticking along. Opportunity is faring a little bit better there. I won't hold it. Back to Nash. This is WS2N.
Yeah, too bad that that wheel, the fixed wheel, doesn't have a way of lifting it off the ground and lowering the other wheels in such a way and tilting the whole thing so that it moves along at a crazy angle a little bit and doesn't have to drag that wheel. They're continuously dragging that wheel in the sand. And so grinding up a lot of electrical power and using up the motors on the other five wheels, it's too bad they're going to do that. Back to the International Space Station. As you describe more and more hardware, and I think this last trip was 17.5 tons of hardware, 35,000 pounds. In other words, the weight of 10 full Cadillacs was just installed in space on the International Space Station on this last mission. And there's a whole lot of these missions. So when you took a look, talk about the total mass in space, I think we're approaching a quarter of a million pounds.
How did they keep it in orbit?
Say it again?
How did they keep it in orbit?
Very carefully. It stays in orbit by Newton's, let's see now, first, second, and third law. Actually, anything is, unless it's acted upon by a force, anything in motion tends to remain in motion. You give it 17,500 miles and a little bit more speed at the right direction, it will be in orbit. It's up there above the atmosphere where there's essentially no drag, so except for a little bit of boosting required periodically because of a small amount of atmospheric drag, it stays in orbit. But you know exactly where I'm going, Bob, and that is that what goes up must come down. It sounds to me like when the total installation is finished, there's going to be a quarter of a million pounds of stuff in space in medium-low Earth orbit. Someday it's all going to come back. Paul, do they ever discuss what the disassembly procedure is like? I mean, let me drop for a second.
W2BL, repeat it.
When we model airplane enthusiasts buy a model airplane kit and we put it all together and fly it, that's great. If we make a great big error and it strikes the ground, if it tries to fly below the level of the local terrain, we say it has been re-kitted, taking it all back apart into little bitty pieces. Not the same ones you started off with. Okay, by the same token, you're putting, I'm just making numbers out of the air, a quarter of a million pounds of stuff in space that someday has to all come back. Has anyone ever discussed the re-kitting, the disassembly, the re-entry procedure? Because when a quarter of a million pounds of stuff comes down, you don't have very much control on something that big where it feels like coming down. If it comes down over a metro area, I guarantee you're going to be unhappy. So, do we ever discuss what the end of this project is going to be like 20 years from now? I'm back to you, Paul.
Oh, sure. Well, I got to mention that one other time. The two ways of doing it, deorbiting little by little, separated, the space station has thrusters on board, and you could actually deorbit it with craft like the Russians have. They have a progress ship up there. Instead of pushing it up, you could deorbit it that way and shoot for the Pacific Ocean. In the future, they're going to have other unmanned craft, like the Jules Verne, being built by European Space Agency. I think that's about four or five times bigger than the Progress ship. That'll be able to do it. That'll be launched, I think, middle to late of next year. It's supposed to go up early this year, but they've had some problems with that. So they'll be able to deorbit it either probably in sections. That's my guess. And shoot for the Pacific Ocean like they did still with the Mir spacecraft. Drop it a second. And I thought they were up to almost a million pounds already, as I remember. You know, you've got the functional actually cargo block, they call that Zarya, that was built by the Russians, that's attached to the gigantic unity module. Each thing is roughly about 14 feet in diameter. Then from the Zarya function cargo block, they attached to Zvezda, that's the living quarters by the Russians, and then eventually we had Destiny attached to the other end of this node. You've got a train of items. You've got the Destiny, node, Zarya, Zvezda, and you've got your address, the 17 and a half tons that they just brought up. Let me drop it. Got trusses coming out of the top of the space station, attached to gigantic another solar panel, exactly as big as what they brought up last time. You've got radiators sticking out of this thing with all kinds of ammonia lines and electrical lines connected to it. Area where, you know, you go to the press and you close the door behind it. It's how the Americans get out to do their spacewalks. They have their spacesuits in there. It's big enough where two of them now sleep in there. It's the night before the spacewalk, we drop it. They go down to 10.2 pounds pressure instead of the 14.7 pounds, which is the same as ambient pressure that we have here on Earth. That's the standard request. They go back inside. They use the bathroom. They eat, clean up. They go back into the Quest lab, depressurize again, and then depressurize further when they get into their spacesuits and do their spacewalk. So that's a pretty big area. You've got different modules attached to this thing, which all add up. Each time a shell goes up there, it brings not 17 and a half tons. That was the biggest payload ever they said they brought up. But a lot of tons they're going to be up to, if they're not already, they're probably up to a million pounds, and I expect that to almost double by the time they finish. Back to you, Dick. That'd be excellent.
Wow. That's a lot of weight. You cannot bring that down in one chunk, because to deorbit that would require a burn so precise and so big, and various portions of that would come flying off of there. Some of them would survive longer re-entry. So, as I see it, when the International Space Station reaches end of life, I think you have no choice but to take it apart into individual chunks of some size and deorbit those individual chunks, maybe with something like Progress ships or whatever. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the Progress is the method by which you take new consumable materials up to the International Space Station, and it is not a reusable vehicle. I think it is sacrificed at the end of that mission. It ends up in the Pacific Ocean. It doesn't come back and land the Progress ship. And so we're going to have to do that equivalent with all these chunks of the space station. On top of that, common sense would again lead people to believe, you can take individual chunks, put them into the cargo hold, and use the space shuttle and bring them back home again. When you bring up 35,500 pounds of stuff like you did in this last mission, you do that by making sure you've got a big enough solid rocket booster and enough liquid fuel on board in order to do all the thrusting required to take that much mass, bring it up from 0 to 17,500 miles an hour, and put it into orbit by aiming it in the right direction, a very precise maneuver. You're obviously putting a tremendous amount of kinetic energy into that 17.5 tons of mass that you're bringing up there. When you bring it back down, all of that kinetic energy returns as heat. We did at one time take a very heavy object when it dropped. The Indian International Satellite that its Apogee boost motor didn't fire correctly, so we brought it back home. As I remember, one of those satellites, we went out there and captured it and brought it back home with the space shuttle. In those days, before we had a Columbia disaster, that sounded like a nice, logical thing to do. You start thinking about the physics involved. You take 35,000 pounds of stuff moving at 17,500 miles an hour. It's got a lot of kilojoules of energy. When you put it in the cargo hold and bring it back home, all that extra energy must be heated by extra heating of your thermal piles on the leading edge of that wing. And so therefore, you're twice as vulnerable, so to speak, to a Columbia disaster when you come back home if you bring back a whole lot more mass. So the chances of someone getting approval for safety reasons to bring this stuff back, no matter how valuable it is, I think it's near zero. It's going to be extremely interesting. On top of that, if for any reason there's a major interruption, like another Columbia situation or some kind of a situation occurring with the supply ships, I just forgot the name of the Russian supply ships, you know the ones I mean. If anything happens with the interruption on the supplies and the boosting so that the orbit slowly decays, that's something to worry about. I think each one of these missions that dock with the International Space Station, if they've got some fuel left over, they boost the space station to a slightly higher orbit as long as they've got some spare fuel. Thank you for Paul for any final comments on this before we go over to anything that Mel wants to add to all this jazz. WS2N, a space person, keep tomorrow up to the tech net.
Wait, somebody else jumped in.
Yeah, Richard, Paul first. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, fine business. The space station itself, the earlier components had thrusters all over to try to keep it stable from, not so much to keep it into a higher altitude, but just to keep it stable. It wasn't until they mounted one of the thrust sections called the Z, that's the Zulu 1 thrust section. And in it, they have these gigantic gyros, basically the heaviest, four of them in there. And that keeps the station from pitching one way or the other. So that's how they hold their station steady. But to get to higher orbits, yes, you're right, the Progress ships, also the Soyuz ships have the capability, and they have used them before. There's always a Soyuz craft attached to the space station in case it's an emergency for the people to return. For instance, now there's three visitors up there, so now they have six on board the space station. They have three seats from the original Soyuz that went up. Let me drop it. That they use as a life raft. The second one that went up now, as the shuttle was coming back, is now stationed also on board. They have the capability of raising the space station, as all three of them, because that went up, including the woman. She's a paying space tourist. Another one, a fourth, to be launched by the Russians. The Progress ship, and of course this new one, it's an ATV, automatic vehicle that European Space Agency is building, which could be bigger, a lot bigger than the Progress ship. We'll have the capability of putting the space station into higher orbit. So will the shuttles, and the shuttles have in the past put it into higher orbit. When you get past 2010, you get to the crew exploration vehicle. Let me drop it. Type of setup. It's not a shell. It's going to be a tank. And on top of the tank, you're going to have this cargo payload that will be able to be launched next to the tank. You'll have two solid boosted rockets. That will be the main carrier for big equipment. It's not built for another, three or four years. And so you figure another 20 years from now before they deorbit it. K2RI, WWS.
Now, the lady who they brought up as a guest, her name is M. Ansari. And I think the Ansari Prize, by which Bert Rutan and the Rutan brothers built the spaceship that Virgin Atlantic is now financially supporting, which went into space twice more than what is it now, 100 kilometers, more than 62 miles high, and it did it twice in a 2-week period. and so they won this prize. I think she was the contributor to that prize. Is she still on board, or did she come back with the International Space Station, with the Space Shuttle? Thank you, Paul.
They were all still on board. They have a crew exchange. The two guys on board will be coming back with her, and the two that went up with her will stay on board. They're going from Expedition 13 to 14. So that's the idea. And they're bringing two up, and they have an extra seat. The Russians figured, why not? 20 million here, 20 million there. We'll do that. Back to you.
So I think she's going to come back down with the next Soyuz mission, which either has been launched or is about to be launched.
Well, the Soyuz is attached to the space station. There's one already attached to it for the existing three people that were on board. And then she comes up with two other guys. Each Soyuz has three seats. So now there's two Soyuz attached to the International Space Station after that 10-day visit of unloading them, loading equipment on, changing out the seats. They have to change out the seats on the Soyuz. The seats are made specifically for each person. They'll have to put the two seats, you know, from the other Soyuz back in. They reverse things, that type of thing. Well, one thing, I think they'll probably come back in the other Soyuz. That's right. They leave it up there for 6 months. They'll be coming back in the existing Soyuz that was up there already. The one they've just bought up will stay there for another 6 months. And that'll be the future lifeboat for the next 6 months.
I can see why each seat is specific to a human being and has to be conformal to that particular body. Because the Soyuz craft land on land, not in the water, so it's in theory a slightly harder impact, and therefore you want that seat to really conform to your body to properly decelerate you during that last second of impact. When is that Soyuz due to come home? When is she due to leave the International Space Station? I think you said she's going to be there for a total of 10 days. I'm guessing she's there for a couple of 2 or 3 days so far. Does that mean she's going to be leaving in about a week?
Yeah, I think they docked on Wednesday. So that means, what are we up to? We're up to probably Friday. Probably around Friday, somewhere around that time there.
Now, she went there because it's an exciting thing to do. She's got a lot of money and she can afford it. She's got an adventurous spirit. One of the best-kept secrets is that of all the people who are in space, cosmonauts, astronauts, visitors, whatever, roughly 50% of all the people put into space spend the first 24 hours upchucking, stomach sick, or seasick, space sick, call it what you like, for the first 24 hours. Fairly unpleasant experience. And you can be an experienced person that's already had two flights before, and the third flight you suddenly get space sick. But it happens. It would be interesting to know whether or not she was one that spent the first day in a very uncomfortable situation, learning how to control all the things that come out of her that she doesn't want to. And in the weightlessness of space, you better catch all that material, or you're going to make the people around you very unhappy. So maybe she'll have quite a story and a book when she comes back home. Let's see what Mel's doing. Mel, we didn't get a chance to have you do much of a talk. I know you're taking it easy these days because you've been through a somewhat unpleasant medical condition. Let's hope that that's all been going well. K2KY, K2RIW in the tech name.
Just one comment about the sickness.
Oh yeah, and I gotta pick up Rich first too before I pick up Mel. Go ahead, Paul, with the sickness.
I haven't heard that she got sick at all, but the one that just came back, Heidi, I forgot her last name now. She was one of the people that did the spacewalk. She did two spacewalks, her and a partner, and then the other group went out. Two guys went out the next day, and then following day, she went out and did another spacewalk at some kind of, I'm not sure where they were. They were probably in Houston. They got up and they got to make speeches. She lost it completely, totally dizzy, and almost collapsed. And then about 10 minutes later or so, they said she did collapse again. So she's got some kind of a problem. It was like one or 2 days. No, it would be one day after returning. So there's some kind of a little problem there. I'll be looking to see it, make sure that, you know, she's okay. I'll check the web, but last I heard, you know, there's no further problems. But, you know, actually collapsing and all that's not good. There's something up with all of that. Thank you.
That particular lady who went through that episode, how long had she been in space, if you happen to know, Paul?
W2V, now repeater.
She was on the SDS-115 Atlantis mission. She was one of the six-person crew, the only female on board that crew that did the installation of the P3-P4 solar panels. So that was the almost 10-day mission. It was extended about a day or so for the year. Unidentified floating object. Let's see, Saturday, 7, 8, 9, 10, I guess 12-day mission.
Each of the astronauts and cosmonauts, when they're in space, do a fair amount of exercise every day to try to keep their muscles in tone. Where she was doing spacewalks, she was doing a lot of work, but not specific exercise to build muscle. She spent 10 days in weightlessness. It would be interesting to find out what the final medical report is on all of that. Rich, I know you wanted to ask a further question or make a comment. N2EO, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2RIW, TechNet, Limehawk, N2EO. I was wondering, Dick, as far as deorbiting, we've got more and more stuff going up, bigger and bigger stuff, more and more stuff. Is it reasonable to expect by the time the space station is ready to come down, they may have the space elevator possibly running to escape velocity and just send it into the sun? Also, something I've been wondering about, if you remember back a number of years ago, during the Reagan administration, I think we were using Star Wars lasers up in Alaska. It was a very interesting coincidence with a Soviet satellite, so-called deorbited, and came down in Canada, above the U.S. border. Is it possible that we might have shot that down with Star Wars back here?
Doubt it very highly. Very highly. No, that was a failure of a Soviet satellite, which did have a nuclear power supply, and it did smear nuclear material over the Canadian terrain, and so it created quite an international incident, and where the United States launched a number of nuclear-powered missions to Jupiter and Saturn, and they had to be nuclear-powered because there's too little solar power out there. And by the same token, anything that goes to Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto also is nuclear-powered. So we go through quite a rigmarole of launching nuclear-powered spacecraft every time we go to the outer planet. There are people who really wring their hands over the danger of that situation. And we supposedly have methods of encapsulating the nuclear power supply so that in the worst-case scenario, it would not breach the containment vessel even as it re-enters the atmosphere and strikes the ground. That's the theory, and I believe there's a 99% chance that that's true, but nothing is perfect, you know that. Great job. Now, when it comes to getting material back out of space from low to medium-low Earth orbit, and that's what we're talking about here with International Space Station, absolutely positively, you have no choice. It will come back to Mother Earth. It sounds nice. Science fiction to say, well, I'll just
throw it like a baseball, and I'll aim it towards the sun. No way in hell. Anything that's in Earth orbit is in an orbit around the planet in such a way that if you did a scale model of that globe you've got sitting on the desk, it's barely outside the paint of that globe. It's skimming along very close to the surface. You and I live in the bottom of an extremely deep gravity well called Earth. To climb out of that well to get to the moon takes a tremendous amount of energy. And that's only a little way out of the well. To climb all the way out of the well to get to Mars requires a hell of a lot more energy. To climb completely out of the well and get to the sun. I haven't done the mathematics, but I'm going to make a guess. It takes 10 times as much booster energy as you used in the first place to get into orbit, to get it that far out of this particular gravity well. So, are we going to send junk into the sun to get rid of it? No way.